So the next and last talk before the lunch break is Sally Horn-Badovinac from University of Chicago. And she'll be telling us about collective cell migrations, and in particular a circling of cells in the Drosophila egg chamber.
Okay, hello. I want to start out also by thanking Thomas for inviting me to this wonderful symposium. And so we're going to stick on this theme of epithelial morphogenesis and talk about a major interest in my... Oh, look at that. Come on, let's see if it'll... Okay, that's not displaying at all. But we're going to talk about an interest in my lab, which is the study of collective cell migration, and particularly how it is that epithelial cells can migrate as a sheet. And we do this, hopefully some of the later movies will play so that you can see this really beautiful movement. So we do this in the context of the Drosophila egg chamber. And what these structures are is this is an assembly of just about 1,000 cells that's going to give rise eventually to a single fly egg. It's made up of a central cluster of germ cells surrounded by a somatic epithelium called the follicle cells. And then the follicle cells produce a basement membrane extracellular matrix, which is going to surround this entire little structure. Now, this image that I'm showing you is an optical cross-section through the egg chamber, but since everything that I'm going to tell you about today is happening at the cell matrix interface, I'm primarily going to be showing you pictures taken right of the surface of this little structure, where you can look at the basal planar axis of these cells. Now, when an egg chamber is actually in the ovary of an adult female fly, they're arranged in linear arrays with younger egg chambers at one end and older egg chambers at the other. And if you take these developmental arrays out of the female and you place them in culture, they're going to show this really tremendous behavior where the entire organ is rotating around its anterior-posterior axis. Now, what you're looking at here, these red balls are the nuclei of those internal germ cells. The epithelial cells are marked in green. And if you've never seen this movie before, it's a little bit ethereal at first, a little hard to wrap your head around. But in fact, this motion is quite easy to understand. So what's happening here? We're going to take an egg chamber, we're going to cut it in half, and we're going to flip it 90 degrees so that now you're looking down the long axis. Now, the reason that the egg chamber rotates is because the basal surfaces of these epithelial cells are motile, and they are crawling on the inside of that basement membrane matrix, which is remaining stationary throughout this process. Oh, good, the movie's playing now. So this is the movie you would have seen earlier, and what I'm going to tell you is this is the migration we study. And so now you're looking directly at the basal surface of this tissue, right at that cell matrix interface, and you can now see the clear crawling behavior of these cells as they're moving along the matrix. Now, the reason that the egg chamber is rotating is that this is part of the mechanism that's creating the elongated shape of the final fly egg. And I'm not going to get into the morphogenesis itself today of how the migration contributes to that process. The one thing that I want you to know is that if you have any sort of a manipulation that blocks the ability of that tissue to migrate, you end up with an egg that's round instead of long. Okay, so today what I'm going to do is the story I'm going to tell is going to be a little bit of a departure of what you've heard so far, because I'm going to primarily be using genetic approaches to tell you about molecular signals that coordinate the movements of these cells. But it's my hope that the system itself is going to be of enough interest that it'll hold your attention. I'm going to start out summarizing some published work from the lab on how these cells coordinate their movements, particularly highlighting the work of a former postdoc, Carrie Barlin. And then I'm going to move on to some newer work from a current graduate student in the lab, Claire Stevenson. So when this rotation of the egg chamber was first discovered, it wasn't immediately clear how the motion was being generated. So my lab spent a fair amount of time just trying to define how these cells were moving on an individual level. And what I'm going to show you is that just like individual cells in culture, these cells have distinct activities at their leading edge versus their trailing edge that are required for their movement. Now, at the leading edge, these cells are forming actin-based protrusions that's under the control of the ARP2-3 complex and the scar wave complex. And the reason that we know this is if we remove the function of the ABI protein by RNAi, here we're doing this in a clone of cells marked in green, we can eliminate the protrusive structures. So just to orient you, this is a wild-type cell with a bright white protrusion at its leading edge, right next to an ABI RNAi cell that lacks these structures. Now, when that protrusion is going to form, of course, it's going to be setting down new integrin-based adhesions to the ECM. Ultimately, however, you need to release those adhesions at the trailing edge of the cell so that the trailing edge can retract and the entire cell body can move forward. Now, we know that the follicle cells have this same release activity through the studies of a kinase called misshapen. Misshapen's targets are not important. The only thing that you need to know is that this protein is required to reduce integrin-based adhesion in the cells. And in fact, when we reduce misshapen function in a clone of cells, again, I'm highlighting these cells in green, you can see that the cells will lose their hexagonal morphology and form these long trailing tails. So this told us that the follicle cells also require a release activity at their trailing edge to allow them to migrate properly. So basically, the take-home message from this early work was a pretty basic one, which is these cells migrate in the way that cells normally do. And what's actually remarkable about this system is the amazing degree of coordination that they show when they're doing it. So this set us out to trying to understand how you could coordinate this motion between the adjacent cells. And in particular, what we chose to focus on was a local interaction between the leading edge of one cell and the trailing edge of the cell in front. Because when an epithelial cell is going to form a protrusion, it actually has to extend underneath the cell in front of it so that you get an organization like overlapping shingles on a roof. And so what this ultimately means is that you need to coordinate the retraction of the trailing edge of one cell with the formation of that protrusion in the cell behind so that the cells aren't competing to bind the same region of matrix. And we really didn't have a good sense of how that was happening. Now, what I'm going to show you is that the follicle cells have solved this problem by having one large transmembrane protein at the trailing edge of each cell, a different protein at the leading edge of each cell, and that these proteins are interacting across cell-cell boundaries to coordinate these movements. Now, the stars of this story are a very large cadherin called FAT2 and a receptor tyrosine phosphatase called LAR. And it's been known for a long time that these two proteins were required to produce that proper shape of the egg. And they've been worked on in this system by a lot of labs over the course of a number of years. But what caught our attention about these proteins is that they show a beautiful planar polarized distribution across the basal surface of the tissue, such that they're specifically enriched right at those leading trailing cell-cell interfaces. The FAT2 protein is specifically localized to the trailing edge. The LAR protein is specifically localized to the leading edge. Now, the way that FAT2 and LAR promote the migration of the tissue is at least in part through the formation of leading edge protrusions. And what I'm showing you right now is a mosaic tissue that's a combination of wild-type cells, shown in blue, and FAT2 mutant cells over here on the right. And what I want you to notice is the wild-type cells have these bright white leading edge protrusions. The FAT2 mutant cells lack these structures. And this was a little puzzling when we first saw it, because I just told you that FAT2 sits at the trailing edge of the cell. The phenotype that I'm showing you is at the leading edge of the cell. And the reason that this works is that this phenotype is non-cell autonomous. So now I'm going to show you another mosaic epithelium, but we're going to look at a clone with a different shape. And what I want you to do is focus on this row of wild-type cells that's migrating right behind a row of FAT2 mutant cells. And what I want you to see is that the wild-type cells lack leading edge protrusions. By contrast, if we're looking at FAT2 mutant cells, that are migrating right behind a row of wild-type cells, the mutant cells form protrusions just fine. So what this is saying is that FAT2 sits at the trailing edge of one cell, and it's reaching out and telling the cell behind it to make leading-edge protrusions. LAR is also required for protrusion formation. In this case, it's happening on a cell-autonomous basis, consistent with LAR's localization to the leading edge. I'm not going to take you through these data. I'm just going to tell you that everything about the LAR phenotype is weaker than the FAT2 phenotype. We think that there's likely another leading edge factor that functions partially redundantly with LAR. We're just going to call this factor X. We don't know what it is. Okay, so at this point, we have two proteins that show a complementary localization pattern and have a complementary effect on leading edge protrusion formation. Are they interacting across cell-cell boundaries? Now, Carrie looked at this a little more closely, the localization of these proteins, and she found that they form distinct puncta within the plasma membrane, and that these puncta show a very high degree of overlap. But what was even cooler is that if you remove FAT2 function from a group of cells, we find that FAT2 is actually required to stabilize LAR in the plasma membrane of an adjacent cell. So I'm once again showing you a FAT2 mosaic epithelium with the wild-type cells on the left. You can see that LAR is localized normally within these cells. By contrast, LAR is largely missing from the mutant cells, and this is once again a non-cell autonomous effect. So if we focus on two wild-type cells migrating behind FAT2 mutant cells, these cells lack LAR at their leading edge. By contrast, FAT2 mutant cells migrating behind wild-type cells localize LAR normally. Okay, so at this point we have a fairly simple model where FAT2 is signaling across cell-cell boundaries to LAR and an unknown factor to induce the formation of leading-edge protrusions. And if this model were correct, you would predict that FAT2's extracellular domain alone should be sufficient to both stabilize LAR and induce protrusions in neighboring cells. And in fact, we've done this experiment, and this does hold true. Okay, so that gives us the protrusion side of this equation, but now the question becomes, do FAT2 and LAR also play a role in trailing edge retraction? So what I'm showing you now, this is once again a clone of FAT2 loss of function cells. In this case, we're using a FAT2 RNAi. And the thing that I'm doing that's different is we're filling up the cytoplasm of these cells with a fluorescent protein so that you can better appreciate their shape. And these FAT2 mutant cells form these long tails at their trailing edges. But what's even better is we also see this phenotype in a LAR mosaic epithelium, but now it's the wild-type cells that are forming the tails. So once again, I want to draw your attention to this group of wild-type cells migrating right behind or right in front of a group of LAR mutant cells, and now you can see that it's the wild-type cells forming the tails. So we were really excited about these data because we think that they're really providing new insight into how you might coordinate these leading and trailing edge dynamics between neighboring cells. And that we have a signaling system comprised of these two proteins and likely others that are signaling across cell-cell boundaries to coordinate the protrusion and retraction activity. And then finally, in data that I didn't have time to show today, we think we've also uncovered a role for the protrusions themselves in helping to release the trailing edge of the cell in front, perhaps via mechanical means. Okay, so now we're going to switch gears and talk about some newer work on the lab that's related to this published work, where we think that we're seeing kind of a general theme of a role for neuronal guidance cues in coordinating cell behaviors in epithelia. So this story actually starts with a forward genetic screen that I performed as a postdoc looking for mutations that create this round egg phenotype. And one of the genes that we identified in this way is the semaphorin 5C gene. Now, as far as round egg mutations go, this one is relatively weak. But by measuring the aspect ratio of the egg, which is simply the length divided by the width, we can see that the eggs from SEMA5C mutant females are consistently rounder than controls. Now, semaphorins are, of course, best known for their role as functioning as repulsive cues during axon guidance. So basically, if you have an axon growing out from a cell body, it encounters a source of semaphorin in the environment, it's going to turn away from that signal to be guided towards its proper target. Now, SEMA5C is one of three classes of semaphorins found in Drosophila. And whereas the fly community has spent a great deal of time looking at the class 1 and class 2 semaphorins, SEMA5C is essentially unstudied. And this is actually somewhat surprising, because among the fly semaphorins, this is the only protein that has direct homologs in mammals. The other two classes are, in fact, insect-specific. So we saw this as a real opportunity to get in and start to identify the function of a relatively understudied protein. Okay, so at this point, we know far less about SEMA5C than we do about FAT2 and LAR, but I'm going to tell you the three things we do know. And the first is that loss of SEMA5C causes a novel migratory defect in this epithelium. This protein signals across cell-cell boundaries, similar to what I showed you for FAT2 and LAR, and that SEMA5C also shows an unexpected interaction with LAR. Okay. So, like most of the round egg mutants we study, loss of SEMA5C causes a strong defect in epithelial migration across all the developmental stages when this movement normally occurs. And so, at first, this didn't seem to be anything particularly interesting in terms of the phenotype. But the surprise actually came when we looked at the actin cytoskeleton in fixed tissue. Now, we know that there is, first of all, I should orient you to this array of actin bundles across the basal surface. These appear to function as stress fibers in this migratory tissue. And we've known for a long time that you have a high degree of tissue-level order in these structures in the direction of migration from before the time that migration begins. And then the tissue-level order simply gets better over time. And we're measuring this using a pneumatic order parameter, where 0 represents no order and 1 represents perfect order. Now, for reasons that we don't fully understand, when you block migration of the tissue, in this case by removing the leading edge protrusions with an ABI RNAi, you start out with that high level of order at the start of the migration, but you lose the tissue-level order of the stress fibers over time, until by the end of this period, you can see that they're still aligned roughly in each cell, but each cell is at odd angles to each other. Now, we expected that we would see this same trend when we looked at the SEMA5C epithelia, and we do up until a point. So up until stage 5, you see this decrease in the tissue level order of the stress fibers, but suddenly you see a recovery until by stage 7, near the end of migration, most of the egg chambers look indistinguishable from controls. And to this suggested two possibilities. The first was that migration might actually be initiating much later than it normally does during development, and that since we can't see the movement through the ex vivo live imaging, then it might actually be extraordinarily slow. And so to test this idea, Claire had to come up with a clever way to look at this system in a different way. And she took advantage of a property in which these cells are actually actively secreting matrix proteins as they're migrating across the basement membrane. So what Claire did was to make small clones of cells that are overexpressing an RFP-tagged version of the major basement membrane protein type 4 collagen. And right now, I'm showing you a confocal slice taken through the cells so that you're seeing the protein still within the secretory pathway. If I now show you a more superficial slice through the basement membrane itself, you can see these tails that extend from the expressing cells, because these are the matrix proteins that the cells have laid down as they've migrated along. And so when you see these tails, you now have a permanent mark in the matrix showing that migration has occurred. Now, David Builder's lab published recently a very similar method that they came up with independently. They call their method M-TRAIL, so if you're familiar with the Builder lab work, this is the same idea. Okay, so to actually look at the data, I'm showing you here again a wild-type egg chamber. These trails are going all the way around the outside because the tissue is migrating robustly. If we have a non-migratory epithelium, in this case from loss of FAT2, the matrix is only being secreted directly adjacent to the clone, showing the lack of migratory behavior. Now, really satisfyingly, the SEMA5C mutant tissue has something in between. We see these very short tails coming from the expressing cells, which tells us that, yes, this tissue is migrating and that it's doing so likely extremely slowly. Now, this image that I just showed you was taken at stage 7, which is that point where we've seen the recovery of the tissue-level order of the stress fiber pattern, and we can see that at that point, 100% of the epithelia show these tails. By contrast, if we look earlier at stage 5, and that's the point where we had that maximal disorder in the tissue, at this point, we see that only 25% of these epithelia show the tails, which is consistent with the idea that migration is initiating around this point. So we think that this is actually telling us some really interesting things about the system and some things that we didn't know before. The most major one being that we had always assumed that having the tissue organized in this way prior to migration might actually be essential to begin the movement. But now we know that this migration can initiate when the tissue is at a highly disordered state, that you can spontaneously organize the tissue in association with movement. And so we're very interested in following up on this and understanding how this process can occur. Okay, so now we're going to talk a little bit about how SEMA5C signals at the cellular and molecular level. Now, the first thing that we wanted to know is where SEMA5C is localized. And so Claire used CRISPR to mark this protein with 3 copies of GFP. And we were excited to see that this protein also localizes along leading trailing cell-cell interfaces, just like I showed you for FAT2 and LAR. And in fact, this is localizing to the leading edge of each migrating cell. Now, the way that we know this is, again, by making mosaic epithelia, where only a subset of the cells have the fluorescent tag. And these cells with the blue mask are lacking the fluorescent tag. I'm going to ask you to focus on these cells that are surrounding the non-expressing cells. So now, as I remove this mask, what I want you to see is that the SEMA5C is enriched at the leading edge of a cell, migrating right behind the unmarked cells, but you do not see a similar enrichment at the back of the cells migrating in front of unmarked cells. So this tells us conclusively that SEMA5C is enriched at the leading edge, not at the trailing edge. Okay, now I told you that there is another leading edge factor that's likely functioning partially redundantly with LAR, and you might be wondering if it's SEMA5C. The simple answer is no. We don't see the defects in leading edge protrusion formation or trailing edge retraction that we would have predicted for this protein. But what we do see is something interesting when we overexpress SEMA5C in this system. Now, if we go back to thinking about this axonal model, where the growth cone ultimately that leads this axonal outgrowth is a migratory structure with a large protrusive front. When it encounters the semaphorin, you're locally inhibiting that protrusive activity, and that's largely what causes the growth cone to turn. And in fact, when we overexpress SEMA5C in this tissue, we see this suppression of protrusive activity. So here in green, these are the SEMA5C overexpressing cells compared to the wild-type cells on the right. And importantly, this is happening by signaling across cell-cell boundaries. Because if I ask you to now focus on this single cell that's overexpressing SEMA5C, you notice it can form its own protrusions just fine. Where the protrusions are missing are from the cells directly behind SEMA5C expressing cell. So this says that SEMA5C has to signal across cell-cell boundaries to have its effect. This prompted us to look for the receptor for this signal, which seems to be a receptor protein called plexin A. We've confirmed that plexin A is required for the migration of the tissue. It also shows this nice localization along the leading trailing cell-cell interfaces. Now, for technical reasons, we don't yet know whether plexin A is at the leading edge, the trailing edge, or both. But since we know that SEMA5C is at the leading edge, we predict that PLEX-A is at the trailing edge, because that's really the only orientation that would facilitate the trans-interaction that's known to occur between semaphorin and plexin proteins. So our working hypothesis at this point, based on everything we know, is that semaphorin plexin signaling could potentially be functioning to inhibit protrusions from happening at the trailing edge of the cell. Now, I'm going to stress that this is highly speculative at this point. We have a lot of work to do to test this model, but it's the way that we're thinking currently at the moment. Okay, so now in the final 1 minute of the talk, I'm going to show, come full circle and show an interesting interaction between SEMA5C and LAR. Now, one of the things that we were really interested in when we found the semaphorin and plexin signaling is that FAT2 and LAR also play very key roles in nervous system development. In particular, LAR is best known for its roles in axon guidance and synapse formation. And although FAT2 has been less studied in this context, there's growing evidence that this is also a key neuronal guidance cue. And so this really made us start to wonder whether or not all of these proteins might be functioning together to guide these epithelial cell movements. And the major thing that we know at the moment is that removing one copy of LAR in a SEMA5C mutant background will rescue the egg-shaped defect seen by loss of SEMA5C alone. And so what this actually suggests, oh, I should say this works with three different alleles of LAR, but we do not see this rescue with FAT2. So this is telling us that SEMA5C seems to have an inhibitory interaction towards LAR that's independent of its function with FAT2. So there's going to be some very interesting crosstalk happening between these pathways and things for us to work out here in the future. All right, final slide. So what we think is emerging here is this idea that you could deploy neuronal guidance cues in an epithelial context. And the reason that we like thinking about this is ultimately, if you're thinking about the steering of a growth cone through the body, what you're doing when that growth cone encounters a guidance cue in the environment is allowing those cells to influence the migratory behavior of another cell. And so for us, it makes a lot of sense that you could deploy these same molecules in an epithelial context to allow each epithelial cell to modulate the migratory behavior of its neighbors. And with that, I'd like to thank my lab, particularly highlighting the work of Carrie and Claire, although I've also referred to Maureen and Lindsay's work, and all of you for your attention. Thank you.